This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 25, Alyssa Guernsey Revisited. I initially covered Alyssa's case on SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com as well as on episode 8 of this podcast. I've been aware of Alyssa's story for many years, and as I mentioned in the initial episode, she was one of the kids whose stories led me down this path and ultimately prompted the creation of my blog and the podcast. You may want to go back and listen to episode 8 to get the full scope of Alyssa's abuse, death, and legal case, the injustice of the sentence given to her killer, and the controversy that has since surrounded Alyssa's story, which I'll recap for you now. Alyssa was born on November 2, 2007 in Columbia City, Indiana, to her mother, Kelly Sprunger, and her father, Michael Guernsey. Just after Alyssa turned one, her dad, Michael, was killed in a car accident. Her mom was devastated, descended into the depths of depression, and soon relapsed into drug addiction. Because she didn't think she was capable of caring for her three children, 6-year-old Lily, 3-year-old Noah, and 1-year-old Alyssa, Kelly asked her cousin, Christy Schaefer, and Christy's husband, Matt, to care for the children while she struggled with her issues. The Schaefers took in Kelly's three children on top of their own 4 children, even though Christy and Matt were both unemployed at the time. During the 110 days Alyssa lived in the Schaefer home, she went from a normal, healthy, bubbly little girl to a nervous, quiet, withdrawn child who was constantly covered with bruises and losing patches of hair. She was seen several times by doctors, to whom Christy explained that Alyssa was clumsy, that she bruised easily, and that her hair was falling out. Tests were run, experts were consulted, but no one came up with any medical explanation for Alyssa's injuries. Even though Alyssa presented with injuries that were clearly inflicted, including a broken arm, DCS did not get involved or remove Alyssa from the Schaefer's custody, and the pediatrician Alyssa saw while with the Schaefer's, Dr. John Egli, just prescribed the baby hydrocodone for her pain. On March 28, 2009, Christy took Alyssa and some of the other kids to rent a movie and pick up Happy Meals at McDonald's. Alyssa's 6-year-old sister, Lily, later told her mother that during that ride, Christy became enraged at Alyssa, who was not quite 17 months old, gripped the baby's hair, and began to beat her, smashing her little head over and over again against the back of her car seat. Alyssa soon lost consciousness. Surveillance video from the McDonald's drive-thru shows Christy getting out of the driver's seat of her minivan, opening the back door, and checking on something or someone inside. Law enforcement believes she was checking the extent of the damage she had inflicted on the helpless baby in her care. When Christy arrived home with her van full of children, she brought the rest of the kids inside to eat before returning to the vehicle and retrieving Alyssa, who was limp, cold to the touch, and unresponsive. Instead of calling 911, Christy called her brother, Nate, who was an EMT. Nate finally convinced her to call 911 while he performed CPR on the lifeless little girl. Alyssa was pronounced dead at Parkview LaGrange Hospital at 9:54 p.m. Postmortem photos taken of Alyssa, which are available to view on my original blog post of Alyssa, but hidden behind a warning image, portray a little girl who was clearly intentionally beaten. Her head and body are bruised, her broken arm is swollen, and inside her lips are 2 vicious lacerations that a DCS report later described as an injury akin to that of an adult punching a child in the mouth as hard as they could. Prosecutor Jeff Weibel convened a grand jury for the first time in his career as prosecutor, and the grand jury chose to indict Christy on nothing more than a charge of neglect of a dependent resulting in serious injury, a Class B felony. Christy threw herself on the mercy of the court, pleading guilty, and Judge Scott Vanderbeck sentenced her on May 25, 2011, to the maximum allowed for that particular charge, which was 10 years. However, he suspended 6 of those years, and of the remaining 4, Christy would only have to serve 2 of them, thanks to Indiana's Good Time Credit Program. At the end of the sentencing hearing, Judge Vanderbeck told Christy and her attorney to come back in a couple of months so he could
entertain a motion for her early release.
When Christy and her attorney returned to court on August 11, 2011, Judge Vanderbeck not only reduced Christy's sentence, he released her on the spot, ordering her to serve 6 months of home detention and 3 years of probation. For the death of 16-month-old Alyssa Guernsey, Christy Schaefer served a mere 77 days in jail. At the time, prosecutor Jeff Weibel said he disagreed with the judge's decision, saying,
"I've never seen a judge suggest a defendant seek a modification. I think he should have stuck with his original sentence, and I think it was the wrong decision, but he's the judge. I was against the modification. I did not think it was warranted. 77 days wasn't enough."
Many people from the area, as well as people from across the country and around the world, agreed. Many suspected some professional or personal relationship between the judge and Christy's father, Kerry Sprunger, a prominent businessman in LaGrange County, may have led to Christy's absurdly light sentence. Many have also blamed Prosecutor Weibel for not filing stiffer charges against Christy in the first place. Protests have been held, rallies have been organized, and marches have taken place, but it is highly unlikely Christy could ever face additional charges. Other than brief remarks to the reporters covering Alyssa's case for Inside Edition and 13 Investigates several years ago, former prosecutor Jeff Weibel has never given an interview about Alyssa's case, which has haunted him over the past 11 years. I reached out to Mr. Weibel a couple of months ago, asking if he might consider doing an interview about Alyssa's case and giving his side of the story of prosecuting Christy Schaefer. I was flattered that he got back to me very quickly and ultimately agreed to talk to me on the podcast about the case. Today, for the first time, you're going to hear the prosecutor from Alyssa Guernsey's case answer questions I know a lot of us have had for many years. Without further ado, here's my telephone interview from August 4th, 2020, with Mr. Jeff Weibel. I have with me today a very special guest. I have Mr. Jeff Weibel from Indiana, who was the prosecutor on the Alyssa Guernsey case. Hi, Mr. Weibel.
Lane, thank you for having me. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. You too. I appreciate you participating in the interview. Can you give us some background on your career, like where you started and some of the positions you've had?
Sure. Lane, I've practiced law for a little over 28 years, approaching 29 years in the state of Indiana. I started as a deputy prosecutor in the early 90s in LaGrange County. In 2002, I was elected prosecutor to 3 terms. I got to serve a little bit more than 3 terms because my predecessor left office early. After those 3+ terms, I was a deputy prosecutor in Noble County for 4 years and 4 months. All along since the early 90s, I've maintained my own private practice. I normally do estate work and business planning, litigation, and I do some misdemeanor criminal defense and personal injury work.
And have you ever prosecuted a case that you would consider as complicated or controversial as Alyssa's case?
I don't know that Alyssa Guernsey's case was necessarily complicated. in terms of it being controversial, I think it's been the most controversial lawsuit I've ever been involved with in 28 years of practicing law.
As we all know, Christy Schaefer, who was the suspect in Alyssa's death, was convicted of child neglect with bodily injury. I know that's a big part of the controversy. Would you say this case has followed you throughout your professional career since it happened?
I'd say it's followed me somewhat, but I think it, I don't know that it was necessarily the original decision that was controversial. My suspicion is, and of course I don't take a poll, but my suspicion is what really made it controversial was the judge's decision, to modify the sentence, 70 or 80 days after the original sentence. I think that's, in my opinion, that's what made it controversial.
Right, sure. That definitely got people out and protesting. I know that that was probably why Inside Edition and 13 Investigates had a lot of things to say about the case. Do you think that the case and its outcome had anything to do with the way your recent Senate run went?
I suspect, and you know, I don't take a poll, Wayne, but I suspect there are people who may have voted for me that it, at the end of the day, did not vote for me. But I do not believe that it came close to affecting the result.
Okay, that's fair. Now, as far as back when the charges were actually filed against Christie, what factors prompted you to convene a grand jury, which you had said you had never done before?
Right. I did convene a grand jury. So Alyssa died, and understand, Lane, this is going on 11 and a half years ago, so I might not get dates exactly right. Alyssa Guernsey died the last weekend in March of 2009, if my memory is correct, and I think it was a weekend. When I got to work the following Monday morning, shortly after 8 o'clock, I had a call from a detective, and I probably had a 15 or 20-minute conversation with the detective, and I knew at that point in time I would be calling a grand jury. And the reason why I knew I would be calling a grand jury is because I knew after speaking with the detective for 15 or 20 minutes that I couldn't be confident about who was responsible for Alyssa Guernsey's death.
Okay. Was it because there were more than one adult in the home?
Well, here's what amounts to, or just a little bit of background. If folks don't know it, Christy Schaefer and her husband were foster parents to a number of little children. I want to say, including Alyssa Guernsey, it was four or five. It might have been more, but I'm not certain. The problem I had is that, as I say, I couldn't tell who it was that actually did the damage or injury to Alyssa Guernsey. And by way of example, I know that Christy Schaefer's husband was in the home at approximately the time that the blow that was struck against Alyssa Guernsey was struck, because I deposed him. So I know that he was there. You see, during the course of the proceedings, I believe that what we established was that the blow that caused Alyssa's death likely took place 2.5 to 3 hours prior to the time that she actually expired. And so when I deposed Christy Schaefer's husband, there was no doubt that he was there. Okay. Now, you know, obviously he didn't say I did it. He obviously didn't say that his wife did it. But the other problem, and this was perhaps at least as big as the problem with her husband, is that there were foster children in that home, and of course foster children have parents. And there was no way that we could exclude either any of the foster parents or anybody else that may have been in that community at the time it happened. I mean, we obviously don't know exactly when or exactly how it occurred, but there were several people that we could not exclude for having done it. And given the fact that nobody saw Christy Schaefer do it, Christy Schaefer never implicated herself. We had no DNA. We had no fingerprints. We had no weapon that could have been used with DNA or fingerprints on it. There wasn't anything in the home that would have indicated that Alyssa Guernsey was flung into a hard object like a wall or a door. So we just didn't have those pieces of the puzzle. And so, I mean, that's really the central problem with the whole case, is that I couldn't say for certain who did it. And And of course, well, the rest is history. But I couldn't say that Christy Schaefer or any other person, for that matter, did it.
Were the other children who were in the van that day deposed, or were they able to be deposed?
Well, the children were not deposed in the sense that they were brought in for a formal deposition and placed under oath. And the reason why they weren't is because they were too young. Now, I do know that one of the children, and it would have been a very small child, and my recollection is she was probably in the nature of 3 years old. She gave a statement to a detective. But at 3 years of age or less, you don't put a three-year-old child under oath. At least I don't know of anybody else that's done it.
Sure, of course, yeah. So. Okay, yeah, I was curious about Alyssa's older sister. I think she was six. I know she was the one who had later told her mother what she had seen, but I don't know if that was something she had mentioned at the beginning or not.
Well, and what I'm not sure of, Lane, is, it's possibly true, but I don't know that Alyssa Guernsey's sister, older sister, was there. I'm not saying she wasn't, but I don't recall that Alyssa Guernsey had another full-blooded sibling that was living in the Schaefer home, if that makes sense to you.
Right. No, I think she was a half-sister. She and Alyssa's older brother were there.
And that may have been.
Okay. Do you think now, based on the autopsy that was performed and those post-mortem photos that a lot of us have seen that show Alyssa's injuries, that neglect resulting in injury was the only charge that could have been laid against Christy?
Well, Lane, the question that you originally posed was it the only prosecutable charge? And,
mm-hmm.
and so I would answer the question this way. You can file any charge you want, but I think you also have to say to yourself, especially if you're the prosecutor, what are my chances of sustaining a conviction? You see what I'm saying? So let me answer your question this way. I think the charge of neglect of a dependent as a Class B felony was the highest crime that we were likely to get a conviction to. And the reason why, and I think I spoke to this earlier, the reason why you weren't going to get a murder conviction or a manslaughter conviction is because you couldn't tell who did it. And so, in the state of Indiana, murder is its own level of crime. Manslaughter is a Class A felony, and neglect of a dependent is a Class B felony. So, I think the answer to your question is that a Class B felony, under the circumstances and under the facts, was the highest crime that we were likely to get a conviction to. And so that's why I pursued it.
Was there any particular reason that you chose neglect resulting in injury rather than neglect resulting in death?
Well, and that's a good question. Neglect resulting in death at the time in Indiana was a Class A felony. Okay. And I mean, the problem is that if you're going to charge her with a Class A felony, neglect of a dependent, I think you might as well charge her with manslaughter as a Class A felony. And I did not think, you see, I think what got her indicted and I can't see in the minds of the grand jurors, but I think what got her indicted was testimony that Alyssa Guernsey was obviously laboring and struggling while she was under the supervision of Christy Schaefer, and that as a responsible adult, Christy Schaefer should have recognized that. And so if you boil it all the way down, I think that, I mean, it's my opinion that that's the fact that got her indicted, and of course that indictment led to the B felony conviction.
Okay, but that documentation is permanently sealed, right?
I don't know where it's permanently sealed or not. So the grand jury proceeding took place in the spring and summer of 2009, and I was in office for another 5 years, And so, I mean, you know, as the prosecutor, there was no need for me to try to unseal the documentation because I was the prosecutor. And now, whether the law in the state of Indiana allows that or not, I simply do not know.
Now, as far as the grand jury, I'm not sure how that whole proceeding works. But if you had seen fit, could you have pressed additional charges beyond those that the grand jury chose to indict if you had thought it was appropriate?
Yes, I could have. But if I was going to do that, then I would have filed those charges on my own to begin with instead of petitioning the court to assemble a grand jury.
All right. And as far as that grand jury went, what evidence did you present to them?
Everything I had. So I would say that the highlights of the grand jury, see, the grand jury actually took place on two different days. And the reason why it took place on two different days is because we couldn't get two doctors in the same place at the same time. I mean, I think it would have been easier for the grand jury to understand the evidence if they got to listen to both of the doctors back to back. But the doctor's schedules just would not permit it. There was at least one other police officer that testified. I don't think any of the children testified, and as I indicated earlier, I just don't know that when you have 2, 3, and 4-year-old kids that their memory is going to be that good and that they're going to be that reliable. And we also submitted to the grand jury photographs of Alyssa's body after she died. So the grand jury saw or what I would refer to as fairly gruesome photographs. The grand jury clearly saw those photographs.
And do you agree with the coroner's ruling of homicide in the case?
Well, here's what I would say. I'm not a doctor, but based on the photographs that I saw, I don't know how it could be. I understand why the doctor said homicide. I mean, it quite arguably was, but before you convict somebody of homicide, you got to have a defendant that you can connect the evidence to. And again, that was the big problem with the case.
Do you have any personal or professional knowledge of the Sprunger family or any relationship with them at all?
I didn't know Christy Schaefer before this. I didn't know Christy Schaefer's mother. I knew who her father was because he was an officer at a local bank. Now that said, he's not a client of mine. I mean, if I walked into the lobby of the bank, I would know him well enough to say hello. And I'm sure that on a number of occasions I did, at least up until the time this happened. And then, you know, after his daughter was indicted, he didn't want to talk to me anymore, which is understandable.
What about Judge Vanderbeck? Did he have any type of relationship with the family?
Well, during the course of Christy Schaefer's sentencing, the judge indicated that he did know Christy Schaefer's father. Whether Christy Schaefer's father was a client of his from before he was on the bench, I just don't know. You know, I obviously don't monitor people's personal relationships, but it was clear that the judge knew her father. I don't have any reason to believe that the judge knew Christy Schaefer.
Do you think that his knowledge of the family or any relationship he might have had would have affected his ability to be objective?
You know, I don't know. I would like to think not. I can't see in between somebody's ears, but this is my subjective belief. I think this case troubled Judge Vanderbeck for a long, long time. And I've known him I've known Judge Vanderbeck for approximately 30 years, and he is as decent and, kind and conscientious of a man as you will ever meet. But, you know, being in the position that he's in as a judge, and he was a judge for, 20 some odd years, you know, you're going to have cases that trouble you and that you make decisions on. And they may be cases that you wish that you can take back and do differently. But, you know, once the decision's made, it's made.
Were you pressured by anyone to kind of go easy on Christie?
Absolutely not. I mean, the case was controversial, and I know that I'd had Christie was from the town of Topeka, and at the time I had spoke to the former town marshal of Topeka, and I knew him relatively well, and I asked him, you know, what the public sentiment was within the town of Topeka, and he said the public sentiment was split right down the middle in terms of either being in support of her or not being in support of her. But, you know, to answer your narrow question, you know, nobody ever asked me to do that.
Okay. And as far as Christie's plea agreement, can you explain how that came about and what it entailed?
Well, in fact, there was no plea agreement. She would not accept the plea agreement that I offered. Okay, so what you have to understand, you know, at the time, this was a Class B felony in the state of Indiana. And so the maximum penalty on a Class B felony was 20 years in prison unless you had no criminal record. And Christie Schaefer, in fact, had no criminal record, at least up to that time. She didn't even have a speeding ticket. So because of her lacking non-existent criminal record, the maximum sentence under Indiana law at that time was 10 years. And so the plea agreement that I offered was 10 years. You know, in retrospect, it may have been a mistake to offer her a plea agreement to the maximum. And the reason why I say that is because she had nothing to lose by pleading to the court. You understand what I'm saying?
Okay, so by just offering her guilty plea directly to the court, she kind of circumvented that agreement.
Yeah, I mean, there literally was no plea agreement that she signed. She threw herself at the mercy of the court. And I mean, arguably what I should have done is I should have made the plea agreement for 9 years. Because then if she pled to the court and the judge gave her 10, she would have had something to lose. So I think the point is there was no plea agreement. And so she pled to the court and sought the court's mercy. She didn't get it immediately, but she eventually got it.
That is for certain. I know you had opposed that, the shortening of her sentence. And that was definitely in the media. I know I have your quote saying so in the podcast episode. Now, over the years, a lot of people have participated in rallies and protests looking for justice for Alyssa, wanting further charges pressed against Christie and so on. But did Christie's guilty plea to that particular charge prevent any future prosecution of Christie on any other charges in Alyssa's death?
In my opinion, double jeopardy principles would prohibit the prosecution of Christie Schaefer for anything that occurred during what I believe was the last weekend in March of 2009. I think that the double jeopardy provisions of the U.S. Constitution and Indiana Constitution would prohibit a prosecution of Christie Schaefer. So I think the answer to your question is yes, and the reason why I'm a little bit wordy about it is because if there was anybody else involved in it, and the charge was, for instance, murder, then there's no statute of limitations on that.
Okay. But not for Christie herself. If there was someone else involved, that was another story.
Exactly. For Christie Schaefer is, in my legal opinion, done with respect to this transaction. She was not done after her sentence was modified. I prosecuted her again, but those were for completely different and unrelated charges.
That was the drug arrest.
Correct. Correct. Okay. That happened after her sentence was modified for the charges related to Alyssa Guernsey. She got in trouble, I want to say, for possession of methamphetamine. So I did prosecute her for that. And her probation was violated on the charge that related to Alyssa Guernsey's death.
And that's why she ended up serving the remainder of the sentence.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Now, as far as Christy goes, personally, do you feel she was responsible for Alyssa's death?
I don't know. I don't know, from time to time, Lane, I ask myself that question. And, I was the prosecutor for a very long time. And so when you're in that position, you're at the confluence of everybody's dirty laundry in a relatively small community. And I know that, you know, whenever I filed a charge against somebody or decided not to file a charge against somebody, the question and the test was always the same, and that is, can I sleep at night? To this day, I'm not convinced that Christy Schaefer committed a homicidal act. And now, when I say a homicidal act, what I mean is an act of murder or an act of manslaughter. Okay. She had no criminal record prior to March of 2009. She had no record of violence. I couldn't rule out the other people in the home. And I knew beyond any doubt that her husband was there. I don't know whether you've seen the photographs of Alyssa or not, but you know, it would be easier for a man to create that kind of damage than a woman, assuming that physically the man is stronger than the woman. And in this case, that would have been true. You know, that's a fair question for you to ask. I can't, as I sit here this moment, pin a homicidal act on Christy Schaefer because of Alyssa Guernsey's death.
Okay. In that case, do you feel that Christy received a severe enough punishment to make up for the loss of Alyssa's life?
No, she did not. No. And here's the reason why I say that. Let's assume it was different circumstances. Let's say that the crime that Christy Schaefer was charged with was operating while intoxicated, resulting in death. Okay? And it was a car accident, and Alyssa Guernsey died as a result of the car accident. Surely Christy Schaefer would have spent more than 70 or 80 days in jail for that, even though it was her first criminal conviction. And maybe that's not the best example, but do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, yep, other circumstances would have made the sentence more severe.
She was convicted of a Class B felony, which is just two rungs lower than the most serious crime in Indiana, and that's worth more than 70 or 80 days in jail, in my opinion.
Why do you think Judge Vanderbeck was as willing as he was to modify Christie's sentence and just release her on the spot after 77 days?
Well, you know, and that's an excellent question. And I think maybe in part, I answered that earlier. Scott Vanderbeck is one of the most decent people you'll ever meet. It could be one of two things. Number one, it could be that he just simply made a mistake. And if he did it, you know, it was a whopper, but he made a mistake. The other thing could have been is that he just simply felt as though that the original sentence of 6 years was too harsh. Now, I don't think it was myself, but the legislature gave him the option of doing what he did, and obviously he took it to the fullest extent.
Well, a lot of people kind of throw the phrase small town politics around about the handling of Alyssa's case. Would you agree with that assessment as far as Topeka and LaGrange County?
Well, when you use the phrase, Lane, small town politics, I'm not sure what you mean. Could you be a little more specific on that?
Yeah, I know that was definitely mentioned by a number of people. It's been a phrase that's been thrown around, but I think what they mean is somebody knew somebody who knew somebody. It was
okay. So, and I guess that goes back to the relationship between Judge Vanderbeck and Christy Schaefer's family. Had Judge Vanderbeck felt that he could not objectively preside over the case, then he should have recused himself. He did recuse himself for the second case, but I have to wonder if that was just not to avoid the controversy. So going in, he must have felt that he could have acted objectively, and whether he did or not, maybe he miscalculated. All I can do is hypothesize about what he's thinking. If you go back to the phrase small town politics, I kind of draw that to his relationship with her father. If he felt that was going to prejudice him, then he should have recused himself at the outset instead of presiding over the entire matter.
Right, right. I think that's an opinion that's pretty widely held, I believe.
I'm sure.
As far as the news coverage that has come out on Alyssa's case, I know it was a few years ago, but the Inside Edition piece and the 13 Investigates both did television pieces about it. Do you feel like that's been fair and truthful, or were some facts misrepresented?
I don't know, because I don't know what they said. I would imagine, Lane, that the coverage that was given the case that you're speaking of was 9 or 10 years ago. And so I don't have any recollection of what the coverage was. And I guess part of the reason why we're having this dialogue and I'm answering these questions is just to give everybody some insight about what was going through my mind at the time and why I made the decisions that I did. So I can't, not knowing what they said, I can't say whether they misrepresented it or not.
It's been a conception in the case that you don't want to talk to anyone or you refuse to speak with media regarding the case. But do you want to clear that up?
Yeah. There's only one person that's wanted to talk to me about the case that I refused to talk to. And I think I knew who he was. And I guess the only reason why I didn't want to talk to him is because I think he's known as a sensationalist, and I just didn't see anything productive coming of it. So I just never bothered to return his call. Any other journalist or any other person that's wanted to talk about the case, I've talked to him about it. So to the degree that there's a perception that I didn't want to talk about it, the perception is incorrect.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up. If you could start at the very beginning of the case again and prosecute it over again, would you change anything that you did?
And I think I alluded to that earlier. After the grand jury issued its indictments, and we got to the point where there was going to be a plea, the maximum she could have got under Indiana law at the time was 10 years. And I guess I felt like, this was, despite the fact that she didn't have a prior criminal record, this was just one case where I didn't want to offer any less than the maximum. Now, in retrospect, that may have been a mistake, because when she opted to deny the plea agreement and plead to the court, she was essentially bargaining with the court and not me. I mean, the judge would have let me argue until I was blue in the face, but, you know, when she pled to the court, the plea agreement's off the table, and that is part of what made her sentence modification possible, because in Indiana, a plea agreement is viewed like a contract, and both sides are bound by it unless both sides want to change it. Well, so there was no contract, and her agreement was with the court. And so that allowed her to come back a couple months later and say, how about a modification? And so if your question is, would I do something differently? In retrospect, instead of offering a plea agreement that was for 10 years, perhaps I should have offered one that was for 9 years, because then she would have had some risk, because obviously her attorney would have said to her, look, you can take 9 years and it's done and over with, or you can risk it and get 10. Was that possibly a mistake? You know, it possibly was. But, and I thought about this question because, you know, we've had this conversation. I just felt under the circumstances of that case, offering a plea to the maximum was the most just thing that I could do. And so that's what I did. And so I don't know that I would change that today if it happened again, but that's the closest thing to doing something different that I might have done.
All right. And to wrap things up, is there any statement you'd like to make to the public in regard to Alyssa Guernsey or the case, or is there anything that you'd like to say or to clear up?
You know, I feel horrible that she died. She was a charming little girl. And, you know, from other pictures that I could see of her. But, you know, when you're the prosecutor, you bear a heavy burden, and your obligation is always to do what is just within your power. Had I been able to get Lane the 9 or 10 year sentence that I originally sought out to get, I think justice would have been done under these facts. And I'm sorry that it didn't happen. Perhaps I should have raised more hell with the judge. You know, perhaps I should have done that. But the problem is that, you know, it's easy for a person who doesn't practice law to berate a judge, you know. As an attorney, you're obviously not allowed to do that. That's what causes you to get disbarred or thrown in jail. And so, you know, I am sorry it turned out the way it did, but at the end of the day, you know, the judge decided that he was going to let her out, and his decision was made over my objection. And even though I didn't like the decision, I have to be respectful to the judge. Because as an attorney, you know, if you're in court any amount of time, judges make decisions you don't like all the time. That doesn't mean that you are disrespectful to them. That's how civilized society breaks down. I wish it would have turned out differently, but it didn't. And I think at every turn, I made the best legal decision that could have been made at the time with the facts.
That's fair. I really appreciate that that answer. And I want to thank you again for agreeing to do this interview and for clearing up a lot of questions that I think a lot of people have had over the years in regard to Alyssa's case. It has definitely touched a nerve with a lot of people, and there's a lot of people out there who didn't know her in life, including myself, but will certainly never forget Alyssa.
I understand, and I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
A huge thank you to Jeff Weibel for agreeing to do a recorded interview on this podcast. During our interview, I forgot to ask Mr. Weibel one of the most enduring and important questions, and that is, why was Matt Schaefer, Christie's husband, given immunity? Mr. Weibel called me on Monday morning to provide me with an answer to that question. He said that since Alyssa's death occurred 11 years ago, some of the details are hard to remember, but he does not remember offering Matt immunity. He said that immunity was not the concern of Matt's attorney, but rather the attorney was concerned about spousal privilege, which means that a person cannot be compelled to testify against his own spouse. However, Mr. Weibel explained that in Indiana, when it comes to a charge like the one Christie faced, at least at the time, there was no right of spousal privilege, so Matt would have been compelled to testify had Christie's case gone to trial. Mr. Weibel said in his interview that he did depose Matt Schaefer himself, but Matt did not implicate either his wife or himself during his deposition. Anyway, I'm interested to hear what you guys think of what he had to say. Please weigh in with your opinions, thoughts, and comments on the podcast's Facebook page at facebook.com/sufferthelittlechildrenpod. That's it for this week, guys. Join me next week for another case. Please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes, leave a voicemail, and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive show merch. Follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and Tumblr at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. I've posted a photo album for today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also read about today's case as well as many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written and produced by Lane. Music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.com. Always remember, hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.